Welcome to the Deep Dive, where we unpack complex topics by distilling the most important knowledge and insights from a stack of sources just for you. Today, you're joining us for the Security Nexus Deep Dive. We're the Security Nexus, a Maryland-based national security consultancy. We specialize in strategic advisory, education, and public engagement, our mission. Well, it's to inform, educate, and empower professionals and the public alike through clear, accessible, and actionable knowledge. If you want more insights into things like cyber threats, hybrid warfare, strategic security policy, you can always find us at thesecuritynexus.net. Okay, so for this deep dive, we've pulled together a really insightful collection of sources. We've got a detailed PSI report on China's impact on the U.S. education system, a sharp analysis by Nicholas Eftimiads on Chinese espionage, and that groundbreaking Mandiant APT-1 report. That one really put a name to the face of state-sponsored cyber ops. Our mission today is to, uncover the complex, multifaceted nature of China's influence and espionage activities, particularly those aimed at the United States.
We're going to explore how China pursues its strategic objectives, from the more subtle soft power things right through to, highly sophisticated cyber espionage. Let's start with China's soft power and influence, specifically through these things called Confucius Institutes, or CIs. Now, these institutes, they're typically set up through a contract, right? Between Hanban, which is now called the Center for Language Education and Cooperation, basically the Chinese government's cultural arm,
right.
A U.S. school, and a Chinese partner school.
Mm-hmm.
And on the surface, their stated purpose sounds pretty straightforward. Teaching Chinese language, training teachers, handling the Chinese proficiency test, the HSK, and generally promoting Chinese language and culture.
Mm-hmm.
Events, speakers, competitions, that sort of thing.
Yeah, it sounds perfectly benign, doesn't it? Almost like any other cultural exchange program.
Exactly.
But this seemingly innocent cultural exchange often serves a much deeper, more strategic purpose. There was a former prominent member of the Chinese government, Li Changchun. He stated pretty openly back in 2011 that the Confucius Institute is, and I'm quoting here, an appealing brand for expanding our culture abroad, contributing to improving our soft power.
Okay, appealing brand. That's interesting phrasing.
It is. And what's really revealing is his very candid admission that, quote, using the excuse of teaching Chinese language, everything looks reasonable and logical. And even before that, he'd called CIs an important part of China's overseas propaganda setup. So it's not just about language lessons. It's about shaping perceptions, influencing thought.
That's a really crucial distinction to make. And what's fascinating here, I think, is how these Confucius Institutes, despite looking like standard cultural centers, might actually encourage a certain complacency, maybe, towards China's bigger long-term initiatives.
Mm-hmm. Complacency is a good word for it.
We're talking about these really ambitious plans like Made in China 2025, which is all about becoming a global leader in advanced tech manufacturing.
Right.
And also the Thousand Talents Program, which was pretty explicitly designed to recruit Chinese researchers who gain knowledge at U.S. universities and companies to bring that knowledge back to China.
Yeah, and the CIs can act as a subtle sort of gateway or enabler for those much larger strategic goals. It helps normalize China's presence and influence within key institutions.
And the control mechanisms they use, they seem remarkably tight, based on the PSI report anyway.
Oh, absolutely. Hanban, the Chinese government entity, it directly provides the salaries and even the living expenses for the Chinese directors and teachers within these institutes on U.S. campuses.
Direct funding.
And crucially, Hanban also retains final approval of the actual agreements between the U.S. schools and the Chinese partner schools.
So wait, a foreign government agency gets final say on educational agreements happening on U.S. soil?
That's what the report indicates, yes. Think about the implications of that for academic independence.
Yeah, I mean, Hanban is clearly pulling a lot of strings there. But what does that level of financial and, contractual control actually mean day to day for academic freedom, for the integrity of these U.S. institutions? Because I saw in the report that some of these Hanban contracts even have clauses requiring U.S. schools to pay back funds if they terminate the agreement early, like before the typical 5-year term is up.
Exactly. That creates a pretty significant financial disincentive to pull out, doesn't it? It effectively locks schools into the relationship, even if concerns arise later.
It really limits their options.
It does. And the PSI report highlighted genuine concerns over academic freedom that came up. Some U.S. school officials definitely expressed worries about limiting events that might be critical of China. There was even an internal review at one U.S. institution. It found a political science professor really concerned about a, quote, manual of do's and don'ts, and also a Hanban class monitor assigned to observe each class session.
A monitor in the classroom.
According to this internal review, yes. And in terms of day-to-day operations, the American directors often have lots of other university responsibilities, right?
They're stretched thin.
Exactly. So oversight of the CIA's daily running often falls to the Chinese director. And remember, that Chinese director is the one responsible for reporting back to Hanban. So they can end up having significant control and steering the narrative.
Okay, so beyond the operational control, there were also some, frankly, startling failures in financial reporting. And issues with visa misuse, too.
Yes, both are really significant.
The PSI report revealed that nearly 70% of U.S. schools getting over $250,000 from Hanban failed to properly report that funding to the Department of Education.
Mm-hmm. Despite clear legal requirements to do so.
Right. And just for context, you know, U.S. schools reported getting about $15.5 million from CIs between 2012 and 2018.
Okay.
But Hanban is estimated to have actually spent around $113.4 million in the U.S. during that same period.
Wow, that's a huge discrepancy, like more than seven times the reported amount.
Exactly. This wasn't just a simple reporting error, was it? That kind of gap suggests a deliberate effort to operate outside the transparency we expect in the U.S., obscuring the true scale of their financial influence.
And it definitely extends to visa issues, which, as you know, are really vital for national security. The State Department actually issued letters of concern and even went so far as to revoke 32 visas for Confucius Institute exchange visitors.
32 revoked visas. Why?
Because they were found to be teaching in K through 12 schools, not conducting research as their J1 research scholar visas required. Those visas are meant for academics, for researchers, not typically for K-12 teaching staff.
So they were using the wrong visa category.
It appears so. And in one instance, a Chinese co-director was apparently caught conducting rehearsal interviews to basically coach people on how to deceive officials during the visa process.
Okay, that's pretty blatant.
It suggests intent. The State Department suspected CIs were deliberately trying to circumvent the proper teacher visa category, probably because it has stricter qualifications and more scrutiny involved.
That definitely shows a pattern of trying to sidestep established procedures. Now, if we flip this around and look at the other side, the lack of reciprocity, it becomes even clearer just how strategically, well, lopsided this relationship was.
Mm-hmm.
The U.S. State Department had its own program, right? American Cultural Centers, ACCs, in China. The idea was similar. Promote American culture, media literacy, English skills.
That's right. Since 2010, about $5.1 million in grants supported roughly 29 ACCs.
Okay, so a parallel effort. But while the Chinese CIs seem to operate pretty freely here in the U.S.,
the ACCs in China faced constant, significant hurdles. It's a really stark contrast in operational freedom.
How so? What kind of hurdles?
Well, the PSI report documented at least 80 examples, 80 of Chinese interference with these American public diplomacy efforts just between 2016 and 2018. We saw cases where Chinese officials basically stifled the establishment of ACCs altogether, or they'd outright refuse to allow specific events, things like a play about Muhammad Ali or lecture series on policy issues.
So censorship, basically.
Pretty much. They even involved local Communist Party members in the approval processes for American cultural programming. It really seemed like a systematic effort to control or just block American cultural outreach on their turf.
And it sounds like it went beyond just bureaucratic interference. Mm-hmm. Was there direct harassment, too?
There were reports of that, yes. The PSI report mentions a U.S. school official who staffed an ACC being subjected to extensive questioning by Chinese police officers about her involvement with the ACC, her links to the State Department.
Wow.
And apparently, a colleague told her that kind of interrogation was common, saying something like, she was now part of the club.
That's chilling. That's not cultural exchange.
Not at all. And significantly, U.S. diplomats were often actually prevented from visiting the ACCs.
So they couldn't even check on their own program.
Exactly. Which really hindered their ability to monitor how effective the grants were or what was actually happening. And that directly contradicts the whole diplomatic principle of reciprocity, doesn't it?
It really does. If this is supposed to be about mutual cultural exchange, why all the secrecy and interference on their side?
Yeah.
It begs the question. Okay, so if these soft power initiatives, the Confucius Institutes, are one side of the coin, it's on the other. Our sources suggest a much more aggressive approach, too. A whole-of-society approach to espionage that casts a really wide net.
That's right. Nicholas of Timiades, in his article on the question of Chinese espionage, really dives into this. He explains that China employs a, quote, massive whole-of-society approach to economic espionage.
Whole-of-society?
Yeah.
What does that actually mean in practice?
Well, it's not just a theoretical concept. It's actually mandated by Chinese law. Article 7 of China's National Intelligence Law from 2017 compels any organization or citizen to support, assist, and cooperate with the state intelligence work in accordance with the law.
Any organization or citizen.
Compelled.
Compelled. And similarly, Article 22 of the 2014 counterespionage law requires relevant organizations and individuals to truthfully provide information during investigations and specifies they must not refuse.
So refusal isn't really an option. Not according to the law. What this means really is pretty straightforward. If the Chinese government requests intelligence assistance, any organization or citizen is legally obligated to provide it. This creates this uniquely integrated system where companies, individuals, they face severe punishment if they don't comply. It demonstrates this powerful combination of societal control, espionage efforts, and information control. It really blurs the lines between civilian and state activities in a way that's quite distinct.
That's incredibly far-reaching. It essentially means almost any interaction, business, academic, personal, could potentially be leveraged for intelligence gathering.
Potentially, yes. And this vast apparatus seems largely driven by China's Made in China 2025 plan. That's a central motivating force behind their push for global leadership in advanced technology manufacturing.
Right, stealing innovation rather than just developing it all themselves.
That's the accusation, supported by numerous cases. Our sources highlight several key industries consistently targeted for intellectual property theft. Things like alternative energy, solar, wind, even nuclear, biotechnology, biopharma, GMOs, vaccines.
Critical area.
Very critical. Also, defense technology, aerospace, armaments, marine systems, radar, optics, space tech. High-end manufacturing like composites, robotics, chip-making equipment, and of course, information and communications technology, core electronics, software, network gear, even environmental protection tech and hybrid electric autonomous vehicles.
Basically anything cutting edge.
Pretty much. And the hundreds of prosecuted espionage cases really prove the extent of these activities. It's not theoretical. It has real-world impacts on the global balance of power and, frankly, threatens economic security worldwide.
Okay, so they have this legal mandate and these clear targets, but what about the how? The actual tradecraft of espionage.
Right, that's a fascinating question. How sophisticated are these operations in practice? Timiades' analysis of tradecraft reveals about four main patterns. They range from, you know, pretty basic stuff like just avoiding open communications or not using true names.
Okay.
To more involved methods like using false names or third parties to transmit information or materials, or leveraging public and commercial encryption and holding meetings back in China to avoid detection.
Makes sense.
And then there's the higher end. Using tailor-made devices or techniques, operating out of third countries, using in-country cutouts. The most frequent methods he found involved using false names or documents for illegal shipping, and also the encryption or meetings in China approach, especially for economic and national security-related espionage.
You'd kind of expect such a massive state-directed effort to be uniformly sophisticated, right? Highly professional across the board.
You might think so.
But if Timothy's research reveals something surprising, doesn't it? A real inconsistency.
It does. He talks about this concept of islands of excellence, meaning some parts are very good, but others, not so much. In fact, in 151 cases he analyzed, he found there was no discernible tradecraft used at all. Individuals just used their true names, open communications.
No tradecraft. Really, for espionage?
Apparently so, in a significant number of cases. And even specifically looking at the Ministry of State Security, the MSS, which is China's main civilian intelligence agency.
Yeah, the pros, supposedly.
Right. Timiades noted, and this is pretty striking, an astounding 17 cases where case officers and recruited agents demonstrated no discernible tradecraft. And only 13 cases in his sample showed what he considered a sophisticated higher level of tradecraft.
It's unexpected. That's so even within their main intelligence agency, it's not all James Bond level stuff.
Mm-hmm. Not according to this analysis. It's a really critical insight, actually. Despite China's huge ambitions and the legal pressure on citizens to cooperate, their intelligence apparatus isn't necessarily this uniformly polished, perfect machine. This surprising lack of sophistication in many instances suggests systemic problems. Eftimiades points to a potential lack of standardized training, security awareness, operational oversight, and case management within the MSS.
So internal issues.
Internal systemic issues. And he notes these same systemic problems seem to have persisted over a 20-year period. It implies that even with vast resources, achieving consistent operational excellence remains a real challenge for them.
That is a fascinating potential vulnerability to consider. Mm-hmm. But to really grasp the level of sophistication they can achieve and the sheer scale of their operations when they're operating at peak, we need to zoom in on a specific example.
Mm-hmm.
A few examples are as revealing as the infamous APT-1 cyber espionage group, active since at least 2006.
Ah, yes, APT-1. The Mandiant report on them was truly a landmark piece of work. Exhaustive detail.
It really was. And Mandiant stated pretty confidently they believe APT-1 to be the second bureau of the People's Liberation Army, General Staff Department's third department, commonly known as Unit 61398.
Pinpointing it right to a specific KLA unit.
Exactly.
And the scale of APT-1's operations, as documented by Mandiant, is just absolutely staggering. They observe them systematically stealing hundreds of terabytes of data. Hundreds of terabytes from at least 141 different organizations spanning 20 major industries.
20 industries? Like what?
Everything. Aerospace, chemicals, education, energy, financial services, healthcare, IT, legal services, transportation, you name it. If it was strategic, they were likely targeting it.
And the kind of data they took?
Highly sensitive stuff. Technology blueprints, proprietary manufacturing processes, test results, business plans, pricing documents, partnership agreements, even sensitive internal communications like emails and contact lists from victim organizations' leadership.
Good grief. Imagine the economic damage, the strategic advantage gained from having all that.
Precisely. It's industrial scale theft of intellectual capital.
And Mandiant didn't just stop at the digital evidence. They provided this fascinating glimpse into the physical infrastructure, the personnel behind Unit 61398.
They did. They located it, saying it's partially situated on Daitong Road in Gaokuajin, Pudongnu area of Shanghai.
A specific address?
A specific area, yeah. And based on the size of the facilities there, including this massive 12-story, nearly 131,000 square foot center building completed back in 2007, Mandiant estimated the unit is staffed by hundreds and perhaps thousands of people.
Thousands. This isn't some small hacker collective in a basement. This is an industrial scale intelligence gathering enterprise, state run.
Absolutely. And what's particularly telling is the direct collaboration they found with state-owned enterprises. China Telecom, for instance, apparently provided special fiber optic communications infrastructure for the unit in the name of national defense.
So the state telecom company laying special cables just for the military hacking unit.
That's the implication. It really highlights the integrated state-backed nature of these cyber operations and the personnel involved. They're specifically trained in computer security, network operations, and importantly, required to be proficient in English. Which makes sense, given their targets were global.
Okay, let's talk about their cyber tradecraft. How did they actually operate? They tried to hide their location.
They did, very cleverly. APT-1 used this extensive global network of hot point systems, basically other compromised computers around the world that they could route their attack traffic through, made it look like the attacks were coming from somewhere else entirely.
Standard technique for covering tracks.
Yes, but Mandiant's analysis was incredibly thorough. They observed that even using these hot points, 98.2% of the logins to those hot points originated from just four large NEP locks in Shanghai.
So they slipped up. Or yeah. Maybe just got comfortable.
Perhaps. And further confirming their origin, the keyboard layout settings found on APT-1's attack systems were consistently set to Chinese simplified U.S. keyboard. A strong indicator of the operator's native language.
And their actual methods, their tools.
Pretty sophisticated modus operandi. They used common tools like remote desktop and FTP to access the hot points. And they used publicly available tools like HCharian, that's the HUC packet transmit tool, to essentially proxy their connections, rerouting them through those hot points to make tracing back to Shanghai much, much harder for investigators.
Okay.
They also cleverly used dynamic DNS and even hijacked legitimate sounding website addresses, fully qualified domain names or FQDNs, things themed around news, tech, business like CNNDaily.com or HugeSoft.org. This gave them flexible command and control infrastructure, the hidden central hubs directing their malware and pulling out the stolen data.
So constantly adapting their infrastructure.
It seems so. And the sheer volume of malware development Mandiant identified over 40 distinct families of malware associated with APT-1 strongly suggests, as they put it, this is someone's day job and not a side project or hobby.
40 families of malware.
Yeah. And they commonly used well-known privilege escalation tools, things like PBDump, FGDump, Mimikatz. These are essentially hacker tools that help them get deeper access inside a compromised network, go from being just a regular user to having full admin control, like having the master key.
What I found truly remarkable about the Mandiant report, though, was the level of detail they got down to, profiling the actual operators behind the keyboards.
That was extraordinary, wasn't it? Giving them personas?
Yeah, like Ugly Gorilla, also identified as Wang Dong. They linked him to the email address uglygorilla@163.com.
Mm-hmm.
That email was used to register the hugesoft.org domain way back in 2004, and it was apparently still active in 2013 when the report came out.
And they found that username, Ugly Gorilla, used across various online hacking forums, too, with IP addresses tracing right back to those known APT1 home ranges in Shanghai.
Leaving digital breadcrumbs.
Exactly. And if you connect this back to the bigger picture we've been discussing, these incredibly detailed forensics provide this rare, valuable window into the actual human element behind these massive state-sponsored cyber operations. It's easy to think of it all as just faceless code flying around, right?
Oh, right.
But findings like these remind us that behind every digital intrusion, there are actual human operators, people with digital fingerprints, people making choices, sometimes even making mundane mistakes like using personal identifiers. Like the other persona, Dota, who apparently used a Shanghai mobile phone number for his Google account verification. That points directly to his physical location and suggests he was responding quickly.
Gave himself away with his phone.
Seems like it. And another one, Super Heart M, or May King, was linked to an email account registered from an IP address known to be used by APT1 for egress traffic in Shanghai. It's this kind of persistent digital trail that allowed Mandiant to build such a strong case.
Yeah, and speaking of strong cases, Mandiant's ultimate conclusion was that the evidence overwhelmingly suggests APT1 is Unit 61398. Just based on the precise correlation of everything, the observed activities, the infrastructure they used, the personnel characteristics, it all lined up perfectly with Unit 61398's known mission and its physical location. It's really a powerful, definitive case study of state-sponsored cyber espionage in action.
So wrapping this up, this deep dive has really, I think, shown us the incredible breadth and depth of China's long-term strategic initiatives, from those seemingly benign Confucius Institutes, which, as we saw, often operate with a real lack of transparency and reciprocity, to that pervasive whole-of-society approach to intelligence gathering where the lines are deliberately blurred.
Right, the legal compulsion aspect. Exactly. And then all the way to the highly sophisticated, industrial-scale digital intrusions, exemplified by the PLA's Unit 61398 APD1.
Yeah.
It really paints a picture of a nation leveraging pretty much every tool available to achieve its strategic goals.
It really does. And, you know, this raises a fundamentally important and complex question for all nations, really. How do you effectively counter such a multifaceted, deeply integrated approach to influence and intelligence operations, especially when, as we discussed, citizens and companies within that nation are legally compelled to participate if asked? It's a challenge that demands so much more than just technological defenses, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
It requires this deep understanding of their legal frameworks, their cultural outreach methods, human intelligence, cyber intelligence. All of it has to operate together somehow. It's a huge challenge.
Yeah, it really is. Well, we hope this deep dive has given you, our listener, a clear understanding of these complex and constantly evolving dynamics and maybe some insight into what they mean for national security and international relations going forward. Remember, this was the Security Nexus Deep Dive. For more valuable insights and resources on evolving global threats, please do visit us at thesecuritynexus.net.